Okay, I'm here with Bridget Frazier, running for one of four people seeking the Bluffton seat on the Beaufort County Board of Education, and with Brian Tolley, our executive editor, and Rick Brundrett, our projects editor. I'm David Lauderdale. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Are you daughter of Oscar?
Yes, Oscar Frazier was my father. I was educated here in Beaufort County school system. Graduated from Hilton High School in 2001. And I went on to South Carolina State University and earned a bachelor's degree in professional English and a minor in secondary education. And Palm Beach County at the time was recruiting for minority teachers to West Palm Beach. The numbers, they were extremely low as far as diversity, and so they offered a very great incentive. Sadly, the salary my first year of teaching was way more than what I'm making now as going into my 12th year. And so I went to West Palm Beach, stayed there for 8 years, and just started missing the area, Bluffton. My family's always been big in the community here, and so I wanted to come back and try to be instrumental as I could. And I earned a master's degree in public administration and with a minor in disaster management. And coming back here, I started working in Battery Creek, teaching high school English, and I was there for 3 years until my decision to run for the board, and it would have been a conflict of interest, and so I left Battery Creek, and I'm now at Hardeeville Ridgeland Middle School, teaching 8th grade ELA.
English language arts. Mm-hmm. And so I thought I'd read you did catering.
Is that? I do. I'm multifaceted. So I do have a catering company. It's called Deliciously Couture. And under that umbrella, my food truck, which is Gullah Fried Sweet. So just about any festival that's going on, we're there. Like we'll be at the upcoming book festival that Bluffton's hosting for the first time, November 18th and 19th, selling things.
And you're at the middle school, and
yes.
Is that what you said?
Yes, I'm at the middle school here, Hardeeville Ridgeland Middle School.
How's that working out?
Interesting, to say the least. I've been in areas where the improvement or like the achievement gap has been it's been pretty low, but in that area, I don't think I've ever seen it to be as bad as it is. For instance, my eighth grade students now. The percentage of students reading on grade level is only at 8%. So 92.6% of the students, they are not on reading grade level. And some students are identified as low as being beginning readers. And so to see those numbers and then to think about the achievement gap going on in our district in Beaufort County, you know, it's obvious to see what things are working, what things don't work. But you also get to see if nothing changes with that, the future for those students become extremely limited. If you're not able to read, I mean, that's a component for any facet a person's going to go into in life. So it's given me kind of definitely a more experienced approach than what I've dealt with before. I've never, like I said, had students who were that low or that great of a number of students who were that low.
So that is a big difference from Battery Creek.
It's a huge, huge difference. Well, even Battery Creek's numbers were a little low. The percentage wasn't there. You go from 8% of students not being on reading level there, and Battery Creek's number from the year that I was there, I think it was maybe 78 to 80% of kids are on reading grade level. But I was in a rural area in Palm Beach County called Pahokee, Florida, that actually drafts more NFL players than any other where in the country. But one of the reasons is it's very rural, and academics there too, the achievement gap there too, in comparison to places like Wellington and Boca Raton, is extremely low. But even there, those numbers may have been, you know, 30% of kids on reading grade level. So 8% it's pretty bad.
Well, that issue of the gap is a big one for Beaufort County.
Mm-hmm.
What could you do as a board member? What would you recommend?
Several things I'd like to recommend is identifying the schools that have the greatest gaps there, because all schools don't have those numbers. And then the numbers go higher than 40% when you look at Bluffton Middle, for instance, their numbers are higher than the 40%. So I would like to bring in a reading specialist into each of those schools who actually work with the teachers in those core classes to teach them different strategies that benefit struggling readers. Being in Florida, one of the things that all teachers had to do was become reading endorsed, because everyone, when we think of reading, we just think, you know, if a student's able to kind of call out words, that's reading, but it's not. It's a skill set as far as being able to comprehend, being able to go back into the text and kind of denote exactly what's going on. So not having those skills as a struggling reader makes it difficult when you're looking at fiction or nonfiction text. I would definitely like to see a reading specialist who could actually give those strategies to teachers to be able to assist them with their struggling readers. And then I think for some students, it would even be beneficial to incorporate a reading class for those students to actually get the one-on-one time to be able to improve their skills. Because if they're struggling in English, people just think, you know, the skill for reading is only needed there. Well, they'll go to math and have those same issues, because if they're struggling reading, they're struggling in math also. And that goes across the curriculum, science, social studies, all those things become a problem. So I think between the reading specialists, assist teachers and those students, and even a reading class, I think would be beneficial.
Would those reading specialists be funded with the additional funding that the state legislature approved for reading specialists, or would this?
It could be funded in that manner, or what I've seen some schools do. Like currently, each school right now has what's called like an LTM facilitator, and that's someone who on teachers' planning gives them professional development or even during professional development days for teachers, they make presentations. But those individuals are all certified in a core subject, and they are equipped with those type of skills. So I think it'd be advantageous to kind of even utilize them, since they're already there, to make that a focus.
Well, as a teacher, do you ever have a chance to just slow down and say, I'm going to have to teach this child reading? Or are they on the... As I understand it, they just have to go, go, go. You've got standards you've got to teach. You've got tests you got to take.
You do. Well, if you go with the grain, you do. I've always been unorthodox, so I don't believe in that. For instance, like they'll say, well, don't teach kids grammar. That's not a part of the standard. That's not a focus. And I'm a professional English major, so to me, I can't teach you how to write or read if you don't know how to conjugate a verb. So I'm going to do grammar, and we're going to do grammar every day. But for a lot of teachers, yes, that is something they've been told, especially if they're in a class where they have an ELC or some a state-mandated test. Their focus is teaching to the test. So whether you can read or not, if you can, you know, memorize these particular things for the test, it's all, you know, the concern is, which is unfair to the students, but certainly to the teacher as well, because they're in a mode where they feel they need to perform, because if their kids perform low on that test, then it's, you know, it comes back somewhat as a punitive thing against them.
Where did you go to middle school?
I was at H.E. McCracken at the time when it was still on Hilton Head Island.
What made you run for the school board? What made you make that decision?
As an educator, I was just tired of the politics, in the sense that everyone who's been on the board or usually gets on the board makes these mandates and passes down these initiatives, but no one ever stops and asks the people who are actually in the classroom what's working and what's not working. And it becomes one of the things where, you know, you just get fed up of just gathering amongst yourself and having conversations on those decisions. And so I've always been politics savvy myself, and with the encouragement of some of my fellow colleagues, and just with the desire myself, I wanted to get on the board and not be a sideline spectator anymore, but someone who's actually there to kind of drive the focus in a direction that's going to benefit the students, the teachers, and even the community.
This situation with the school board and the makeup days in this last week, How would you have seen that done differently, if at all?
I think for starters, if you're going to present something in a way that gives parents the option to make input and you give the impression that it's going to be weighted, then what the parents choose along with the perspectives of administration is what should have been chosen. And from that last meeting, that was not the case at all. So it's almost like, you know, the board itself just keeps creating, you know, tensions not necessary with mistrust and other things. And to go and do a decision like that where parents felt that they were not, their voices were not heard and their concerns were not heard also, I just think that that was definitely done in poor taste. And then here we are today with the emergency meeting where they rescinded again that option. So it's like, you know, the consistency, and it's like it's clear there's a lack of leadership because you have people who've now adopted to the change, begrudgingly or not, they adopted to that. And so now to come out today and say, okay, scrap that idea, we're going to go back and update the calendar and we're going to go with, you know, option four now, you know, I just think it's definitely unfortunate. But my original thought or suggestion on that is before getting the parental consent, if they were just going to go and make the decisions as, you know, the leaders in place to do that, there are a lot of options that they could have, you know, looked at. A lot of concerns were, well, why push the semester back? You get a testing window for EOCs, and you can, with the semester ending before Christmas break and the kids having missed 9 days, that wouldn't have worked out for the students. So pushing the semester back, they can do those EOCs coming back from break. And anyone concerned, well, they're going to lose. It's a loss of instructional time. Well, we've done that before. And what happened is the students would go home with an enrichment packet, which would be kind of like, you know, a study guide for them. They know what the benchmarks are, the standards they're going to be tested to. And it was somewhat of a refresher to them, opposed to trying to cram in, you know, testing now, because we're probably like 3-4 weeks out from the end of the semester. And then the state has already waived a certain amount of days. So it's like, you know, you have built-in days, already half days, and built-in teacher work days. Why not make those days full instructional days where you didn't have to change the calendar or didn't have to change graduation days? And also that suggestion was made to the superintendent by an administrator, and he didn't go that route. And so we're here now with the debacle of the makeup days.
What is your opinion about the sales tax for the school district?
I see the need for funding for certain capital improvements they've outlined, but I'm not a fan of the sales tax as proposed in at this particular moment in time. And the reason I'm not a fan of it right now is for several reasons. I think with all that's gone on, it's very difficult to try to pass that when you already have so many people in the community outraged with the board and with some of the mishandlings and ethical violations of the superintendent. And you use that with the county also asking for a sales tax and kind of creating like what's called a voter fatigue. You know, I don't think this was the best time to propose that. It's like asking the constituents for too much all at once. But one of the main reasons I'm against it is when we look at the regular operational fund, general fund that the school board works off of, I'm not a fan of how things, what the current fund is being utilized. So even though the sales tax money is only going to be used for capital buildings of new buildings or improvements, I don't think they manage the first budget, you know, in the most optimal way. And when I say that, there are a lot of things internally that people don't realize or don't see if they're not in the system. So to think that a teacher only has a certain amount of copies that he or she can make in the classroom, and once you go over that, then you don't have the ability to make copies that you need, and you like a little sales receipt of some sort is kept for you. So when you go over, you'll get a message that says you're unable to print. You don't have any more funds in whatever your little copy thing is. So with things like that and the fact that with the budget, they decided to write out hall monitors and make teachers cover lunchrooms for lunch duty or cover halls to monitor students, you know, going into the bathroom or not. You know, it's just like, before we focus on what's going to happen if we have overcrowded or dilapidated buildings, my thing is what's going to happen if we can't retain teachers. And as we're seeing 200-plus teachers every year leave from this district, either going into other states, other districts, or other professions, I think that's more of a pressing issue than anything else. I think it'd be pointless to have newer buildings and updated buildings, and we don't have the teachers needed to fill them. So I'd like to see them go back and use the current budget in a way that's going to actually do something to impact our educators and even students, and restore the trust of the public before the sales tax initiative is presented, because we didn't don't have to wait for it to be a general election to make that that referendum. We can do that on a non-general election time as well. So it's not a rush for people to be like, well, if you don't do it now, you never can do it. We can come back, I think, at a later time. I'd like to see more workshops where they kind of really inform people of what's going on. This is the need. This is the projected cost of it. This is why we're doing that. And not just say, these are the projects that we have. We need the funding. Please vote yes. I think it needs to be a little more explicit than that.
What would you do to help reverse the trend of 200 teachers leaving a year, if that's your most, if that's your top priority? You said that needs to be addressed first before we get to the capital outlay.
Well, for one of the things, like I mentioned with the hall monitor, I think you've got to allow teachers to feel that the support is indeed there. Anyone who knows anything about an educator, they don't just teach, you know, children. They're a parent to some kids. They're a counselor to some kids. And they're already, you know, we're already overworked as it is. And so to pile on, you know, more inundation of things that go outside of their normal duties is unfair. And then to do that at a time when you're not compensating them in an area that's, or pay that's not commensurate with the living wage, you know, I think it's like you're just creating almost like a teeming pot for those teachers to not be here. And so I would like to see the reinstatement of more support staff, like hall monitors, you know, to at least alleviate the fact that your planning period can be just that, for you to be in the classroom making the plans that you need for the upcoming days or the upcoming week, and even remediate students that need that additional time, and not breaking up a fight in the cafeteria, which, you know, as a teacher, if you're there, that's not your, it's not something that you're trained to do in the first place. And oddly, teachers are doing just that.
Do you think the main issue is low pay, relatively low pay to the high housing cost in this area?
I think that's definitely a huge portion of it. But I think that's just a drop in a bucket. I think teachers look at the pay and they know it's not enough. But then when you pile on everything else and you consider the pay, then it becomes, you know, unbearable. So it's, you know, the things like, you know, the state has a mandate now. We get mandates every year on a new way to create a standard. So now teachers have to make SLOs. I'm not sure if you guys know that's called Standard Learning Objectives. Well, it's like a 4 or 5 page objective on one particular standard you're saying you're going to address in the classroom. Well, you have to create this on top of everything else that you're already doing, and you have to meet with an administrator twice a year on your SLO for a pre-assessment of data and a post-assessment of data. And so it, you know, goes along with the idea of, like, how much data do we need to analyze to know some of the basic things. We have an achievement gap problem, and, you know, there's an issue with students, or there's an issue with teachers just in general of just being being burdened down with so much. So it's like we don't need to keep looking at data. That's not the issue. There are other things that we could be addressing as well. So I think you couple that with all the other things they're doing, it's just, and then the pay, I think that's just a camel that breaks the, or the straw that breaks the camel's back.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the thing that you took advantage of in Florida, would that work here?
Well, most definitely, if they went that route, Florida, it was very competitive what they did. They started at that time, a starting teacher made $36,000, and this was 2005. But the area that I was in, because it was a rural area, you also got an additional $5,000 to stay there for 3 years. And then because I lived in Wellington and taught in Pahokee, it was like an hour and a half drive every day, you also got a travel supplement. So it's $8,000 with the $36,000. And then if you're a coach or an advisor to a different group, then you get an additional. So, I mean, my first year of teaching, I was like at $50,000. And coming here with the master's degree and 11 years of experience, I'm not near that. So, you know, it's like that's an issue, you know. And when you look at having longevity in the field, everything goes up and your pay moving in increments of $200 to $300 a year. That's not even the fraction of the taxes that you see, you know, being taken from your salary. So I don't know if they could offer that here as far as funding-wise. I think that was a great idea. Maybe I think what should be done is, like, if they were to research where Florida was able to get that type of money from to be able to offer such an incentive, because it worked. Myself and five other teachers from South Carolina State all picked up and went there. So it definitely was something that drove people to the area.
What did you, what was your thought about the superintendent's run-in with the Ethics Commission?
I think it was definitely unfortunate in a sense that it even got to that level, that it went all the way to the state. I'm more so disheartened that nothing's been put in place to prevent a similar occurrence, or at least send the message to him that the tone of the board is that we're not in the business of supporting or even working under the supervision of someone who's been convicted of ethics violation.
Do you think he should be fired?
I don't know that I think he should be fired. I definitely think that the board, however, should send the message to him that, you know, he doesn't get to get just like a blanket of loyalty or support, even if you're convicted of ethics violations. I think something has to be done on their part that's a clear understanding to him and to the public that, you know, such a violation, again, won't be tolerated. And he should, you know, have some sense of atonement that he has to do as well to restore a break or breach in trust. And I'm not calling for his firing only because I've seen situations like that play out in other areas where if someone is contracted and if the wording itself doesn't stipulate, you know, if you make a breach in ethics violation, it's automatic grounds for firing. If something like that isn't in place and you just fire them before their contract is up, you know, that person in turn is able to sue the district. And if we're already struggling with paying teachers and say that we need money for funding of buildings, how can you justify paying out a lawsuit, you know, and
something? Well, you raise an interesting point. Should that clause be in, if it's not in there now, should that ethics clause
well, it
be
should.
In future contracts, either for this superintendent or any other person?
It should. I think that would definitely be a step in the right direction, even to restore for the community that they're serious about anyone who's going to come into that role that would violate ethics violations. So that wording, I think, should be there.
What do you think would be the best thing to do to improve student achievement?
I mean, there are a lot of things that could be looked at. I know one of my platform issues is that we have to stop this whole teaching to the test idea. I think we shorten and dim the lights of so many students when we look at education or we look at teaching a child from just a one-size-fits-all method in learning. They call it differentiating instruction or multiple learners. Everyone doesn't learn the same way. Me, myself, I'm a visual and a kinesthetic learner. So my learning approach, I like to be hands-on, and I like to see what it is I have to do. And if I'm just being lectured to, that's not the best way to necessarily reach me. And our classrooms don't mirror the progressive world that we're in. So I think, one, we need to and we must look at how we're teaching kids in comparison to the world that we're trying to prepare them to go out and compete in. So I think for student achievement, we have definitely got to reach them or engage them in a way that's going to make the learning meaningful to them and even something that's valuable.
Well, that's something that the state and Congress seem to have taken that choice away from schools, away from the district, away from teachers. You've got to teach to a test. Do you feel that? You have to.
Well, I feel you can certainly, you have some room there. Like I said, my teaching style, I've always been unorthodox, but every job, every teaching, every school that I've been at, have an open door to return because I produce results. And I think one of the things that allows that is, as an English teacher, of course we're going to write essays, of course we're going to, you know, have grammar tests, we're going to do things like that. But if we're reading a novel, we're at the point where I'm not going to make you every novel. Your assessment is a book report. I feel that you can show me what you've learned just as equal as a book report as you doing a 3D presentation, for instance, on a theme, a major theme that was covered in the novel, or even if you wanted to. I've had students put together a game board of the novel that they've done, and each piece on the game board may have been a particular unit covered in the novel or the characters or the main idea. It's like if you allow a student to learn in a way that they can teach that same principle to another student, that impacts them more and lasts more than me teaching you to memorize something for a test that you're going to forget once you take the test.
What is it going to take? What would you think is going to take South Carolina to pull up the Corridor of Shame schools?
Responsibility. And that was a question that I actually got to ask at the Chamber of Commerce Coffee and Candidate meeting. I don't know the representative who was there, but that was one of the things I asked him about. And the Corridor of Shame, you know, I think it's just as much of a travesty or volleying back and forth as the issue with our roads. The state actually has a lawsuit against them from the districts and the Corridor of Shame because it was proven that they were underfunded in the way that they should have been funded. But now the state has an issue where they've accepted that, but now it's like a drawn-out process of, well, let's go back and review, you know, more aspects of that litigation and not actually saying, okay, we did drop the ball. This is what we're going to do to move forward. Because those areas is like Jasper County and other places where students are reading only on grade level as a percentage of 8%. So I think until the accountability comes in, we're not going to see any change. And it's sad because the federal government is giving money to those areas and the state isn't. But the only people that suffer in those areas are the children and then who grow up to be adults, you know, can't really go out into a workforce or even try to impact some change in their own communities.
Well, is it more preschool? Is it more early child?
I would say preschool, elementary, and then even when you get to high school, because preschool and elementary, those are the foundation buildings. And so teaching a child at that age the basics of reading and math and other things is instrumental because their minds are like little sponges. And so if we teach them that in preschool and elementary, that's fine. But then we also have to look at high school. And if we have students who are supposed to be ready to be college ready or actually ready to go out into a trade skill or technical field, and we're not doing that also, I don't think we should just look at early intervention, I think we have to also look at that child in their young adult stage as well, especially when we see statistics that say the workforce is going to have all these jobs available, and we see some of them now with places like Goldstream that are still looking for things as simple as cabinet makers. So our focus, I think, has to be on all those components. Mm-hmm. I think we're losing kids in the early stages and the later stages mm-hmm. as well.
Well, is there anything in your platform or your main priorities that we haven't talked about?
No, I think you guys have hit all my main priorities. The achievement gap, retaining teachers, and restoring public trust are my three top platform issues.
Can you talk a little bit about your philosophy, your commitment as a public official to communicating with the public, the community, particularly when things get tough, mm-hmm. and facing criticism and transparency, the use of executive session. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I think any public official owes it to their constituents to have that sense of transparency throughout, and not just when things get heated or things get tumultuous. One of the initiatives that I address that I'd like to do is have, if not bi-monthly, like quarterly workshops with those in my district and surrounding districts if they want to come, but just to let them know what's going on, because everyone doesn't go to the board meetings. There have been board meetings I've been to and it's probably been 10 people. And then there are board meetings where you have issues like the other night and it's a packed room. And so I think it's a need of like meeting people where they are, because they're still owed a sense of what's going on and to kind of be kept up to date on that. And so I believe public officials get out of touch when they stay kind of confined to their offices or wherever they are and not actually go out and do what they did during the campaign times as far as door knocking and being visible in the public. I think you have to maintain that once elected as well. And that's something that my father often did that served as an inspiration for me. I can remember being a child and sitting and listening to him in different churches. He would go around, especially to the churches in the Black community, and urge people of the importance of showing up at town council and telling them some of the things that were going on in the community or some of the things that happened in those council meetings that they may have missed. And people appreciated that because, you know, it wasn't like you just show up to get our vote kind of thing. You're also keeping us informed and up to date. So even though we're not there physically, we know that you're there and you're going to come back and keep us abreast of what's going on.
Well, Bridget, that's our 30 minutes. I appreciate you coming.